Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
From KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. It's been a year this month since civil war broke out in Sudan, and its impact has been devastating. More than 8 million people displaced in what's being called the world's worst hunger crisis, as 18 million face an imminent lack of food. Now the United Nations is warning of a dramatic escalation in tensions between the warring parties in northern Darfur. This hour, we take a closer look at conditions on the ground and how a nation that appeared to be on the path to democracy after decades of dictatorship under Omar al-Bashir has fallen into civil war. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The United Nations on Friday warned of a, quote, dramatic escalation of tensions among warring parties near El Fasher, North Darfur. The area is already on the brink of famine, and an attack on the city could have terrible consequences for civilians. The crisis in Al-Fashir comes as Sudan's civil war between the Sudanese Armed Forces and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, enters its second year. The conflict has left more than 15,000 people dead and forced more than 8 million to leave their homes. We look at the impact on civilians and the forces driving the war. And joining me first is Sudanese scholar Ali Dinar, who has family in Darfur. He's senior lecturer in the Department of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Ali, so glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thanks to KQED for the opportunity.
Oh, that's kind of you to say. Also with us is Beverly Ochieng, senior journalist and Africa analyst for BBC Monitoring. Beverly, really glad to have you as well.
Thank you so much for having me on the program, and nice to meet everyone else.
So, Ali, your immediate family is in Al-Fashir. How are they? How are they managing?
My immediate family is in Al-Fashir, my brothers and my sisters, nephews and nieces, and they were just living day by day. They can't plan ahead of what is happening the next day or so. So they just taking it one at a time. And that is the feeling they have, just like with the residents of the whole of Al-Fashir. They don't know what will happen next day. So it is life in suspense.
Oh, the area, as I have seen reported, is being bombarded almost daily. How are they coping with the bombardments?
Yeah, the bombardment is almost every day. They were lucky in the past 2 days. They don't been visited. The city was not being visited by the jet fighters or by the Antonov to drop some bombs there or barrels. But I think trying to be away from those places which were affected a lot by moving within the town itself to the places which they give them some sort of false comfort or faint peace. So that is what they were just doing.
Are they still trying to move around, or are they trying to stay and hope that that's the best option?
Based on those people who just move around, just move from Darfur and went to the Central Sudan or to Northern Sudan, the experience they have is not just that rosy. And a lot of them just came back. For a lot of them, there is the places to which they could just move and find very peace is a bit opportunities for those in Al-Fashir is just very limited. They are not those who are closer, to the borders, and they could just sneak around. And so a lot of people in Al-Fashir, they just stayed. But Because at some point also they received those who were affected by the war from Niala, from Jenina. They came to Al-Fashir thinking that like this is the most protected place, but that feel of protection is now evaporating day by day.
Yeah, as I mentioned in the intro, the U.S. and the U.N. warned late last week of an escalation of attacks and tensions in Al-Fashir. How is your family talking or thinking about this?
Yeah, people are just very nervous. People are very nervous about what is going on because, like, they were just being used to these scrimmages between the armed groups and the RSF, like, just for a long time. And so they were just being used to the artillery and mortar shells, like, just the sounds, like, even just like yesterday, I was just talking to them and while I was talking, they said, like, do you hear that? And I hear something on the phone from a distance. They don't know exactly. They know the direction of where this shelling are just taking place. So that was the the life of the people. I mean, that could just be during the day and during the night, like just very early in the morning, like just around 1 or 3. That is where these jet fighters or Antonov will just come, like just during the night when people were just like just having sleep, and then they were just being awoke from that on the sounds of these heavy, like just rockets and barrels and explosions and so on. So it's just very scary situations, and I think also because of the amass of the armed forces, like just from those from the Darfurian, like just armed groups who align themselves with the army, with the SAF, and so the place is just like just filled with all those people, like just with guns, and that doesn't give like that a good sense of peace for the civilians.
No, there's been no electricity or running water for months, I understand. Is your family able to access food at this point still?
I mean, they were better than others. I mean, they could just access food. And I think like the thing which is like just being there in Al-Fashir is that like just people are just communally like just share what they have with others, okay? And that is like, that is something which is just good. And I think like also because like, of the location of Al-Fashir, for a while, like just things coming to it, like just merchandise and food stuff coming to it, like just from neighboring places, whether from Libya or whether from Chad and so on. So that like just make it the stream of food supplies, like just relatively coming to Al-Fashir, like just more than in other places, like just in Sudan. But like now, because like of this recent like just scrimmages also in this border town, it's called Mellit, which is just that is the place from where like this lorries like just coming from northern Sudan or from Libya or so on, these food trucks and other merchandise get into Al-Fashir, and now they have been stopped. And so that is like just led to the skyrocketing of food prices, and also increased the sense of insecurity among the population that like maybe something bad will happen. So it is not a good situation.
Yeah.
The thing
The
thing you mentioned also about lack of water and lack of electricity, that has been is just really, it is very sad because it give you a sense like apart from problems like just in getting water for drinking and other like just house hold like just use, Al-Fashir, like people were just very fond of planting like just trees. Like you can go to a house without like just having say at least like just a lemon tree or guava tree. And unfortunately, because of the lack of water, like just all these trees like just died, you see. So it came like just a barren, like just a desert or a semi-desert town, rather than just being a place which is very lush with all those people, which they grow, even with the limited amount of water which they just have. So that is also.
We are definitely hearing reports about it being on the brink of famine. Well, Ali, I so appreciate you sharing what your family is experiencing, and I really give you my best. I'm so sorry about what it is that they must be going through. Ali Dinar is a senior lecturer in the Department of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, a Sudanese scholar with family in Darfur. Beverly Ochieng, can you just remind us who the factions at war are in Sudan? We heard Ali referencing them, and just quickly, what ignited the conflict? We just have a couple minutes before our break here.
Oh, yes, the war broke out a year ago when there were deep divisions between the two military factions. That is General Burhan, who's the commander of the army, and General Hemeti, who leads the Rapid Support Forces. There were reforms underway after the military coup that took place in 2019. There had been hopes that the country would be moving towards democracy. One of the biggest things in contention had been what security reforms would look like. So a unified armed forces, and Hemeti's RSF was supposed to be integrated in the army. And those were deep, that he was upset by it. He wasn't willing to give up force. So there were two centers of power. And over the weeks when there were talks, just leading up to last year in April, there were talks towards that integration, towards what the political future of Sudan would look like. And then there were mobilization of the various forces in strategic sites like Meroe towards the north, in Khartoum, which is the capital, and other parts, including Darfur. And then the war broke out when it seemed evident that the two sides, Hemeti and Burhan, who had come together during the coup in 2019 and even 2021, could not agree on what happens to the Sudan's future going forward.
So essentially, it was the military that was also involved in the overthrow of Bashir. And ultimately, they came to an agreement that the RSF would basically be absorbed by the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces led by Burhan. But that's what you're saying totally broke down.
Yes, there were supposed to be reforms whereby there would just be one armed force in the country. And you remember the RSF had been brought together from about 2014 by the former president Omar al-Bashir. He was consolidating what was known as the Janjaweed militia that had been involved in the genocide in Darfur. And this paramilitary force is quite powerful. They have large numbers of forces. They had supported the coalition in Yemen, where the Saudis and the UAE were fighting against the Houthis. They had also been involved in Darfur in the gold mines. So they had not just military power, but also political and economic leverage.
And it's that power that RSF General Hemeti does not want to lose.
No, he doesn't. He's been trying to build himself as a bit of a statesman ever since, particularly the 2021 coup, when he now started to split a bit with Burhan and they were differing over whether they will involve certain political factions in Sudan's future. He was involved in diplomatic visits on behalf of Sudan because he had been the vice president of the country under the Sovereign Military Council. And over that time, he was trying to present himself as what would potentially be the future leadership of Sudan.
I see. So they both have power that is hard to give up. We'll have more after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about the war in Sudan, the conditions on the ground, the forces driving the conflict between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. We're talking with Beverly Ochieng, senior journalist and Africa analyst for BBC Monitoring, and with you, our listeners. What are your questions about the war in Sudan? Do you have connections to the region? What involvement would you like to see the U.S. have in this conflict? The email address is forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. We're on X, Instagram. Our digital community is Discord. You can call us at 866-733-6786. And Beverly, can you just help us understand the impact that the war has had on Sudan's infrastructure?
Well, it's been devastated. So Khartoum, which was where everything would be moved from, there was the main airport. That's where the major bridges are connecting various cities, most medical facilities, schooling. People would be going to Khartoum to be able to get most of their services to be able to leave the country. But now it's been it's almost completely flattened. There are almost no medical facilities. Millions of people have been forced to flee. And it means that people are having to move outwards. A total of 8 million Sudanese have had to leave the country overall, or parts of the country, and move to the outskirts. There's almost no airport or no way of bringing in air supply. So humanitarian aid has been arriving by road, mostly in the border points where there's no heavy military fighting or military presence. There's almost very little security, particularly in the urban areas. And given the fact that most of the security forces, including the police, are now involved actively in the war, it means that there's a high level of lawlessness. In terms of media and infrastructure, the main journalist union said that they've lost touch with more than 100 journalists over the last 3 months. Internet and mobile reception has been intermittent for the most part. People rely heavily on mobilizing from the diaspora, whether it's trying to find a way out of the country, and sometimes people lose contact for days or weeks on end. Electricity has been erratic. And then bearing in mind that the infrastructure in Khartoum has been supporting neighboring countries like South Sudan with moving oil all the way up to the eastern Port Sudan city. And that's been completely damaged. Sudan did say they will try to have repairs or to repair some of the damaged infrastructure, but it's almost impossible given how much active fighting there has been and the fact that much of the war in the city has been urban warfare.
Well, I want to bring into the conversation now Susan Stigant, Director of Africa Programs for the United States Institute of Peace, and also Susan from 2005 to 2011 served as program director with the National Democratic Institute in Southern Sudan. Susan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
We heard Ali describe what his family was going through, but what would you add about the humanitarian crisis broadly there? What else do people need to understand about what's happening in Sudan?
Well, as Ali said, people are facing really terrifying circumstances. And because the war has been protracted, and because it's also impacted on the banking system, because people haven't been able to plant in this agricultural season, and because there are so many barriers to move assistance into and around the country is, as you said, facing the largest hunger crisis in the world. And so what we're seeing is that there's really a need for urgent action, creative approaches, and particularly to activate the incredible capacity of the Sudanese, these mutual aid self-help groups that have developed where communities are establishing kitchens, community kitchens, and what they're calling emergency response rooms to that are required, feed people, provide midwife service, provide medical service, and to respond in places where the international community simply has been unable to reach.
Mm. So, yeah, in terms of the challenges of activating these powerful networks within Sudan, what are some of those challenges without the international community also contributing? Yeah.
Well, these are networks. They're not traditional organizations. They don't necessarily have bank accounts established and can't move money around. These aren't entities that can write project plans or talk about monitoring and evaluation. They are operating often without internet, without electricity, without regular access to fuel. And so it requires a different funding structure and a different funding approach that depends on activating these community relationships and is less dependent on some of the more traditional mechanisms that are typically funded through the UN and other large institutions.
Yeah. Susan, we're also hearing from the UN Human Rights Office of children being forced to fight, of sexual violence being committed against civilians, among other war crimes. What can you tell us about this?
The level and the type of violence is truly devastating. There are some really courageous efforts taking place, again, primarily led by Sudanese women and men and young people to document and report what is taking place. Some of the women who have delivered messages to those who are leading the war, they've said that the priority is to ensure that there are protection mechanisms for them, to ensure that part of the humanitarian response includes services and healthcare for the survivors of this type of violence, and guarantees that this type of violence will not continue beyond. But unfortunately, these are currently asks and continue to be very difficult to activate.
One of the things that you wrote recently was that, tragically, the war in Sudan doesn't make news. History has dulled the impact of headlines. What about its history?
Well, I think for many people who haven't had the privilege of spending time in the country or visiting the country or knowing the families and the generosity of the Sudanese people, they might look at the history, and if you told them Sudan is at war, it wouldn't be a surprise. Sudan lived through a long civil war with the South, which then separated in 2011 as an independent state. Many people will remember in the 2000s the activism across the United States on college campuses, bringing attention to the genocide that took place in Darfur, where we're seeing terrible violence again. In a moment where there are so many terrible things happening in the world, where there's so much violence, where there's so much crisis, and with Sudan's long history in navigating this complex situation, I think it's hard for these devastating situations to be newsworthy in many ways.
Susan Stigand is Director of Africa Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Susan Page is Professor of Practice in International Diplomacy at the University of Michigan, and I want to bring her into the conversation now. She's former U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of South Sudan, which she served from 2011 to 2014. Ambassador Page, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
I do want to ask you about the effect of the war in the region, and in particular, South Sudan. A fragile peace agreement is still in place there, but is it in danger of unraveling? Are there pressures there that could lead to that?
It's complicated because so many of these conflicts in the region are intertwined in some fashion. As our colleagues, as Susan Stigand just mentioned, as well as Beverly O'Chang, I mean, South Sudan relies on the ports in Sudan to export their oil. So with the war in Sudan, South Sudan is suffering greatly because that's the main source of their revenue. In addition, you have the Juba peace agreement that was signed a few years ago, where different parties are supporting parts of the two warring factions. And although they had kind of an informal agreement where the two parties, the RSF and the Sudan Armed Forces, would each sort of stay in the west and the east with a bit of a buffer zone, My understanding is that that agreement has sort of broken down that kind of neutrality with the signatories of the Juba peace agreement. So it's kind of just unrest and unsettled, along with all of the humanitarian crises that have been taking place in the region that we've already talked about.
Yeah, Beverly was talking about how at least 2 million have left the borders of Sudan, 6 million or more are internally displaced. To what extent, Ambassador Page, is South Sudan able to absorb refugees from Sudan?
Well, they have been doing so, but it's a fragile country itself with very little infrastructure. Susan Stigant knows this very well from all the time that she spent in South Sudan as well. I mean, there are just very few roads. And during rainy season, roads are impassable. I mean, what dirt roads that exist. And as you mentioned, the fragile peace, I mean, many people would say there isn't really peace, but at least there's a semblance of some sort of working arrangement. And all of this just puts more pressure on a very unstable government with unelected officials in power.
Beverly, how do the people of Sudan, in terms of allegiances, line up behind either the RSF or the SAF? Or is it impossible to know?
I mean, that's very complicated because it's changed over time. And a lot of it you see with the political factions constantly splitting up and how the RSF and the army capitalize on that. So at the start of the transition in 2019, there was support in tandem for the army because they had gotten rid of Omar al-Bashir. At this point, the RSF and the army were indistinguishable. And people were then calling them in the months afterwards to relinquish power to civilians. Yeah. There were various civilian factions that did emerge. One of the key movements, the Sudanese Professional Association, chose to stay outside completely because they did not want to work together with a military that was almost as, in their opinion, compromised as the regime of Omar al-Bashir. And then there were other factions like the Forces for Freedom and Change, which chose to work with the army and got into a transition agreement. There was a lot of support, for instance, for the ousted Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok, because he'd been an economist. He was seen as a reformist, even though he was working with the military. But when he was ousted and then almost forgave the army and the RSF, there was a lot of derision towards him because people felt that he had sort of sold out on the ideals of that revolution that had propelled the civilian forces that were now trying to push back against absolute military rule. At the moment, there are some resistance groups that are trying to work with the army, and the army has actually asked them to form a sort of pseudo-government in the interim as they try to figure out what the political future will be. There are some armed groups that have aligned themselves, particularly those in Darfur, with the RSF, various Arab militias, but they don't really represent what the future of Sudan will really look like because they still demonstrate that there are deep political divisions. These are likely to be very heavily exploited. It makes it difficult to bring any side on the table to have meaningful resolution. And I think for many Sudanese, they feel that ultimately they will be left out of the political process because there's a lot of clamoring around the elite political class and the military elite who have always held power throughout the years.
Yeah. And also, Susan Stigant, to what extent is the war between the RSF and the Sudanese army an ethnic conflict? Is that also one way to characterize what's happening there?
That's another incredibly complicated question. I think one of the developments that I worry about is beyond the fighting that's taking place between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, there has been a mobilization, a so-called popular mobilization of communities. There's been a call for people to arm themselves, a call, on the other hand, for communities to stand up for inclusion of groups that have historically been excluded from governance. And so perhaps a better way to describe it is there appears to be a quite fully mobilized civil war. And this raises important dilemmas and questions about even if the leaders who are leading the fighting parties agreed to stop, it's not clear that this would actually stop the fighting across the country and into communities.
Well, given that, I'm curious, Beverly, about how countries surrounding Sudan and other Middle Eastern countries are aligning in their support of either the Sudanese army or the SAF?
Well, yeah, that's been part of the issue with how to bring the two sides, Hemeti and Burhan, for talks. So some of the immediate reactions were condemnation towards the both of them for starting the war. Yeah. But then how the two sides took that message depended on how they perceived their allegiances of those countries. So with South Sudan, there was some receptiveness towards President Salva Kiir possibly leading the negotiation efforts. But he's dealing with an election back home and, you know, the continuing effects of the civil war from 2013. And then Kenya was seen as being biased towards the RSF because some RSF commanders have actually been in the country. They've been interviewed by Pan-Arab media, which hasn't quite looked good for the government. Then you look at a country like Chad, which has been implicated in apparently sending weapons from the United Arab Emirates to the RSF. So that also compromises the possibility of them leading a mediation effort. Egypt, towards the north, is seen to be close to Burhan. So the RSF sees it as with suspicion, and they do not trust President al-Sisi to lead negotiations. So essentially, the IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority and Development process, collapsed because the various countries not only have internal conflicts, but are also seen to be biased to either side of the military and the RSF. And then with the Arab League countries, we've seen the UAE, which has been accused of a disruptive role. And in fact, as the UN Security Council prepares to meet today, there have been some reports of them trying to leverage with Western legislators so that they're not held accountable for some of the allegations of sending weapons to the RSF. We've seen Saudi Arabia try to play the mediator role together with the US, but they have not been able to consolidate a meaningful or long-lasting ceasefire or to even compel the two sides to have face-to-face talks. So all of that sort of cacophony and the suspicion and the fact that there's been so much upheaval between the two warring factions has meant that any peace process being led either by the US or Saudis, by the IGAD initiative, by the African Union, has collapsed. And the fact that they were too late to consolidate those processes, because by the time Jeddah was being backed by everyone, at this point, the rhetoric by both Hemeti and Burhan showed that there was no going back to any pre-war conditions.
Mm. So really prolonging this war, Beverly.
It is.
Yeah. And what was the expectation when it broke out? I mean, did anyone imagine that we would be talking as the war enters its second year, Beverly?
No, at the start, in fact, some of the accounts that we're seeing were people were hoping that the fighting would just be something short-lived, sporadic, and that it would end. But it kept going on, particularly because both sides have never really been known to back down. They are battle-hardened, having been involved in the insurgencies in Darfur and the Kordofan and the Blue Nile regions. So for them, it's all or out. And the fact that there was just throughout, if you look at the transition, there were moments where it seemed as if there could be a glimmer of hope. So the initial 2019 agreement on what the government could look like, it stalled at the point where they had to decide what the legislature would be, who would share power with which faction. The Juba peace agreement had so many holdout groups as well, fairly powerful groups, which now have been involved in the conflict. And then you look at the time just before the war broke out, and it seemed as if there was one faction that could have joined the government. So it doesn't seem as if either side is about to stand down.
Beverly Ochieng, senior journalist and Africa analyst for BBC Monitoring. Also, Susan Stagon, director of Africa programs at the United States Institute of Peace, is with us. And Ambassador Susan Page, professor of practice in international diplomacy at the University of Michigan, former U.S. ambassador to the Republic of South Sudan. More with them after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A year of war in Sudan, we're looking at conditions on the ground, the forces that are driving the war. And I'd like to turn now to how the global community is responding, could be responding. We're talking with Susan Stigant, Director of Africa Programs at the United States Institute of Peace, Beverly Ochieng, Senior Journalist and Africa Analyst at BBC Monitoring, and with Ambassador Susan Page, Professor of Practice in International Diplomacy at the University of Michigan, also Professor of Practice at Michigan Law and Director of the Wiser Diplomacy Center at the Ford School at the University of Michigan. She's former U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan from 2011 to 2014. And you, our listeners, if you have questions about the conflict, if you have connections to the region, you can email forum@kqed.org. You can find us on X, Instagram, or on our digital community on Discord. We're at KQED Forum on our social channels. Our phone number is 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Ambassador Page, I know we were talking about how fragile the peace agreement is between Sudan and South Sudan, but what do you think we could learn potentially from that peace process that might lead to some kind of ceasefire in Sudan?
Well, unfortunately, I think that, as Beverly mentioned, a big part of the problem now is that so many of the players are considered to be biased one side or the other. I would like to say that during the peace process for Sudan from 2002 to 2005, that there was a little bit more harmony between the relevant actors on the mediation. So the IGAD member states, you don't really have much of that right now, as Beverly mentioned, but you do have Saudi Arabia that, you know, Secretary Blinken is in Saudi Arabia right now. And while it's important that he, the statements from the State Department, the press releases about his trip, of course, mentioned peace in the region of the Middle East and a meeting of the GCC, but they didn't mention at all Saudi Arabia's role in mediating the peace talks in Sudan. I think that's a real miss. I think that's a missed opportunity, because even if it was a small amount of money that was raised, 2 million euros was raised at the France-based international conference on Sudan between about April 15th and 16th. And at the end of that, there was an announcement that talks would be restarting on Sudan in Jeddah in approximately 3 weeks. Well, we're now 1 week left of that time period, and we've heard nothing about any resumption of peace talks. And this is a really critical moment where it looks like the RSF is poised to attack El Fasher. So I think that there are a lot of lessons learned, but it's very difficult for people to splice themselves and recognize that there are a lot of people who could help, but we also have to seize the moment and not be only thinking about one particular conflict, because a lot of them really do interact.
They really do interact. Beverly, what kind of pressures is the war putting on neighboring countries? Of course, the pressures of refugees we haven't talked about yet in Chad, for instance.
Well, yeah, I mean, many of them have received hundreds of thousands of refugees. And these are countries that are already in political and security fragile states. So with Chad, they've had a rebel insurgency for years. They're going through a transition, which will probably just keep the same leader in power. With South Sudan, they're looking forward to an election at the end of the year. They're also facing their own internal conflicts, especially near the border with the armed groups, and internal ethnic conflict. So that's sort of spiking up in some areas because of that additional pressure. There's also the fact that politically, their own involvement is compromised, not just because of the perceived bias, but also because they are not just concentrating on the external crisis that's been brought by Sudan, but also sorting out the internal crisis. So Chad did try to host a sort of ministerial level meeting to mobilize humanitarian aid, but the concern has been most of the routes through which they would be able to send aid in, beyond just the accusations of the UAE is using it to send arms, they're also compromised because criminal activities do take place there perennially. If you look at the Central African Republic, which has also received nearly 30,000 refugees, they're not in a condition where they're able to mobilize any form of aid for the additional refugees that they're receiving. Politically, they're also quite fragile. With Egypt, there were contention over documentation, things as simple as just being able to move people across the border to reunite with their families. And then ultimately, because of all of those various pressure points, it becomes very difficult in terms of what do you prioritize? Is it the political solution towards the war when you're not able to get the two main factions to hold talks together? Is it mobilizing aid, but then how does the aid then get into Sudan and to those who are really in need? Is it being able to provide services in borderlands where state presence has always been compromised as a result of long-term insurgencies as well as insecurity? So it's a lot of things that countries are juggling in addition to the stretched resources. There are other conflicts in Gaza with Ukraine, which have taken attention away from the crisis here. And if you're looking at this building up from COVID-19 up until now, it's quite a big burden for these countries.
Could the fighting, the violence spill over across Sudan's borders into these neighboring countries?
Yes, there have been some concerns. So there were, in the very early months of the conflict, there were reports in Chad, for instance, that some armed groups had been moving there with weapons. And it meant that people were also being targeted when they were fleeing. In South Sudan, there's been some reports of certain factions within armed groups or even the military joining the army or joining the RSF to fight alongside them. And with Libya, there's been concerns about what the Russian mercenaries could be doing to try and get aid, military aid towards the RSF. And even as far as Uganda, there was a report on Sudan State TV at some point last year that weapons were being moved into the Kordofan regions from some Israeli firm operating off of Entebbe to the RSF in the region. So if you're looking at that, it's quite complex. And even in Eritrea, allegations that armed groups that are affiliated with the Sudanese army are receiving training and some support there to possibly join the military in its offensive.
Well, listener Nizar writes, thank you so much for shining a light on the conflict that sometimes gets forgotten by the rest of the world. I am a Sudanese American with many family members still in Khartoum and north of Khartoum. I welcomed President Biden's appointment of a special envoy a couple of months ago. Why are we not seeing direct engagement between the envoy and the two belligerents? It seems most of his meetings over the past 2 months have been with civilians who are on the sidelines. There doesn't seem to have been any movement on resuscitating a peace process. It just reinforces the perception that this war is on the world's back burner. Susan Stigant, do you have an explanation potentially for our listener in terms of their view that President Biden is and his appointment of a special envoy is not resulting in engagement, direct engagement with the belligerents, as Nizar describes them? Susan Stigant? Or Susan Page, do you have a take?
Sure. I think that the special envoy is in a tough position because we don't have an ambassador in Sudan anymore. It seems pretty clear that our policymakers are stuck. They don't seem to have very many good ideas. And again, that's one of the reasons why I said that Blinken's trip to Saudi Arabia, which is also going to he will also be participating in a conference of the Gulf Cooperation Council members. And that's a perfect opportunity to at least put Sudan back on the radar. We're not hearing much. I do think it's extremely important, though, that the special envoy is holding meetings with civilians and is holding meetings with the groups that Susan Stigant mentioned, that are doing their own thing to try to help their neighbors, to help people. It's really, remarkable the things that they are doing in the absence of robust security, in the face of massive humanitarian challenges. They're really, it's not even stepping up. They are doing the work. They are getting things out to people on their own through creative means. It's youth, it's women, it's the kitchens that Susan Stigant mentioned, it's supplies. It's these resistance committees that have turned into being mini governments because the government no longer exists. And so I do think that that is really critical, because the people with arms are certainly not listening to what the civilians actually want.
And we are trying to reestablish that connection with Susan Stigant, Director of Africa Programs for the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's based in Kenya. Ambassador Page, though, I do wonder how you characterize the international community's response to this war. Beverly mentioned, yes, there is so much going on. There is so much global suffering with regard to Israel's war in Gaza, to what's happening in Ukraine. How do you think the international community has been, or the U.S. has been, in terms of responding to this?
I think one of the challenges has been the fact that we have, in some senses, contracted out a lot of our policies on Africa. And we have failed to understand just how much the world is so much more globally connected these days. And so, for instance, when we talk about Saudi Arabia hosting peace talks, but Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, as has been mentioned, have allegedly provided the RSF, Hemeti, with supplies because they are also fighting the Houthis in Yemen. Hemeti is allegedly receiving a lot of money from, again, some of these countries for his gold, and he controls the gold mines. But that then means that you've got implications of Qatar, UAE, other countries that are also benefiting off of not just the war, because this was happening before the war, but the business connections that the different leaders or military groups, or even in the past, other high-ranking Sudanese officials controlled. And that, you know, we can't afford in some instances to push Qatar in one way because they're helping with the negotiations with Hamas because we don't have direct relations with them, nor does Israel. So where maybe we would want to put pressure on, we don't want that to upend where they're playing a constructive role somewhere else. Hmm. And that's part of the problem, is that so much of this is really intertwined, and you need people with a really solid understanding of those exact connections, not just Africa, not just the Middle East, but all of that. And you've got Russia involved, you've got other countries, you've got Ethiopia involved with the Grand Renaissance Dam, which impacts Ethiopia, which impacts Egypt. So you've got interests, but they are really substantial ones. It's not just about money. I mean, Egypt, it's the dam, which is their lifeline.
Yes, so many different and sometimes competing interests. Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Listener Mitch asks, is there any evidence of Russian involvement in this conflict? What is the evidence that you're talking about, Ambassador Page?
I can't say that there's specific information right this minute, but there had been an agreement, a deal, with the Russians to create a naval base in the Red Sea area. This was while Bashir was still in power, and then it continued. At least it was an agreement that had been made. It just was never signed. So there has long been Russian interest in Sudan. They would like access, like everybody, to the Red Sea, to the port. And that's a similar argument with other things that they need from the countries in Africa. So the Russians are heavily involved in Central African Republic, in Niger, in Chad, in a lot of these regions that are on the borders of Sudan. So it's not surprising that there is at least some interest, even if they are not necessarily active in Sudan.
Yeah. And Beverly, given what we're hearing Ambassador Page laying out, are you hearing anything about a ceasefire possibility in the coming weeks or months? Or I guess who would even have the authority or credibility to broker one, given all of these different interests?
Exactly. That's the issue. And I mean, with the fighting in El Fasher, which is the only major town in Darfur that's still with the army, it's not likely. It feels as if both sides want to have a sort of upper hand, either have declare an entire region as their own. So with the RSF possibly in the west, the Sudanese army possibly in the east with the north, but also being cautious about how they call that out so that they know what territories they actually have control of. But the last messages during Eid by both Hemeti and Burhan didn't indicate that fighting was about to stop. In fact, they want victory over each other.
At the very least, is there any way to more effectively and immediately get humanitarian assistance to the region? We're hearing about 18 million people on the verge of acute hunger, 24 million needing humanitarian assistance. I understand in Paris there was supposed to be a commitment of aid. How can that possibly happen, some effective way of coordinating humanitarian assistance?
I mean, that's been very difficult. The army has not been trustful of most UN agencies. They have opened up some corridors, and the RSF has also claimed to be giving security for aid to be able to get to people. But the RSF has also been accused of using aid to sort of leverage on population. So sometimes they forcefully recruit by dangling food and supplies to people. And they know that people are desperate to be able to, you know, still retain some sense of power. And even the Sudanese army, aid is becoming a means of wielding power because they want to open up corridors that would also allow them to have control of certain parts of the country. So it's very difficult, and airdrops are very unpredictable, very expensive. It's hard to know who's going to receive it where, given that it's even difficult enough documenting the people who are dire in need.
Ambassador Page, we just have a minute, but what leverage does the U.S. in particular have to force a ceasefire or to broker a ceasefire?
Well, I guess I would say that leverage is always a question that we think we have a lot of leverage when we don't, or we think we have little leverage when we actually have a lot. It's a matter of getting all of the players together, figuring out what they want, what their interests are. And as Beverly said, the biggest problem right now is both of these military men want to win the war. And that's not what the population wants. But if there's not the willingness to really institute a ceasefire and move on, it is very, very difficult.
Yeah, and the civilians are very much caught in this crossfire. Well, Ambassador Page, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of South Sudan. Beverly Ochieng, thank you as well. Really appreciate hearing your reporting and analysis.
Thank you so much for having me.
Beverly Ochieng, Senior Journalist and Africa Analyst for BBC Monitoring. My thanks also to Susan Stigant, Director of Africa Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace, who joined earlier, as well as Ali Dinar, Sudanese Scholar and Senior Lecturer in the Department of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, with immediate family in Darfur. Thank you, Susan Britton, for producing today's segment. Thank you, listeners, for your questions. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
There are true monsters in the world. People doing horrible things with impunity. Still, every once in a while, there is born a monster hunter. On the next Snap Judgment, The Road to Boito. Snap Judgment, storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.